Hello and welcome to the Now Spinning Magazine podcast with me, Phil Aston. And on this episode, I'm absolutely delighted to have with me Steve Rosen, who is a journalist extraordinaire. And I'm saying that because people like myself, sitting in front of our little YouTube channels and, you know, finding our feet, and I've just started, as many of you know, I've started to interview some artists and I'm really enjoying it, etc. And then Steve approaches me to talk about a book called Tone Chaser, about his friendship with Eddie Van Halen for over 26 years. And as I did my research, I realized that Steve is the real thing, the real deal. He has spoken to these bands when they ruled the world, the Zeppelins, the Purples, ZZ Tops, the Humble Pies. I could just go on, Jeff Beck's. And so Steve was there. It's like having somebody from the film Almost Famous sitting in front of me who went on these flights with the bands. And here he is. So welcome, Steve, to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, man. What a very, very welcoming introduction. I appreciate that, man. Happy to be here.
Fantastic. Well, I'm going to focus a little bit on the book and then I'm going to bounce back and forwards, because you got in touch with me to tell me about the book, where you've been friends with Eddie Van Halen for 26 years. And sadly, we lost Eddie not that long ago. You first met him, I think, in 78, just at the cusp of when the first album was going to come out. Is that right?
Yes. Actually, Phil, I met Edward in June of 77.
Oh, right.
Right, which was about, so the first record comes out in February 78, so it's in, what, 7 or 8 months before the record comes out. I'm at the Whiskey one night. I'm there with my brother. I'd been to the Whiskey a lot. I would go to the Whiskey a lot back in the days, man. You know, all these bands, as you mentioned, Phil, when they were, you know, a lot of these bands were just kind of starting out at that point, you know, so Aerosmith had their first record out in the mid-70s, and you know, these bands that ultimately became huge back in the day, they were playing the Whiskey. So Steve Tripp is recording a live record at the Whiskey. The following year, they would record the live record in Budokan and blow up. But in 77, they were playing the Whiskey. So I was there with my brother, my friend Michelle Meyer, who booked the Whiskey, knew that I was writing for guitar magazines. I was in the thick of writing for a Guitar Player magazine at the time. She said, look, there's somebody you need to meet. So we go upstairs to one of the grungy Whiskey dressing rooms. And standing in the corner is this very kind of slender guy with this amazing head of hair and, you know, smoking a cigarette. And we walk over and she introduces me to Edward Van Halen. Besides never hearing the record, because the record wouldn't be out for several more months, I had never heard Van Halen play live. I had never seen them at the Whiskey or the Starwood, which, as I mentioned, was strange, man, because literally I was at the Whiskey 3 or 4 nights a week. I was always at the Starwood. So how I had missed Van Halen, I'm not quite sure. So, so we meet and we talk and, you know, we find this common bond. He loves Eric Clapton. I love Clapton. I love Cream. I mean, you know, All that early, you know, the male stuff. We talk about Ritchie Blackmore. Jeff Beck's name comes up. And it's just all these bands that I've loved, you know, and Edward loved as well. And so you just kind of, it's just like you're talking to a buddy. It's how my brother described it when we went home. I go, was he as nice as I thought he was? And my brother said, yeah, it's like talking to a friend. So it was a pretty remarkable night. And, I'm glad I went out that night to go check out Cheap Trick, right?
Wow. I mean, because Eddie Van Halen was, when he emerged, he changed everything, didn't he? He changed the guitar landscape, you know, that first album. And did you stayed close to him then in the following years? You were with him with each successive album that came out?
Correct. Yes. So several months go by, and in fact, I interview Ed, I believe it was at the beginning of 78, again, before the record comes out. So I'm talking to him. This is a phone interview. And strangely enough, and I write about this over and over in the book, Edward never remembered He never remembered certain events. I don't think he remembered meeting me at the whiskey. He was extraordinarily friendly on the phone, but I don't think he made that connection, which was weird and would happen over and over again. I would introduce him to Les Paul, Richard Blackmore, and Billy Gibbons, and he never remembered any of those events. Anyway, so it's now February 78. I received the first record in the mail from Warner Brothers, right? I'm on the Warner Brothers mailing list. And so each month I would get all of the releases from Warner. And I love Warner because I had so many bands that I loved on Warner. Sabbath and Purple was on an offshoot of Warner's. Captain Beefheart, Beach Boys. So I get this record and go, oh, yeah, that's that guy, Edward Van Halen. You know, there's the four pictures on the front cover. And I put it on and I was not impressed. Wow. I could not understand what was everybody hearing? I didn't hear it, you know? I mean, I can remember hearing, you know, Jeff Beck's Truth the first time. And, you know, Machine Head, Nin Rock, I understand those aren't first records. But, you know, the first Zeppelin record.
Yeah.
I mean, those records blew me away. And that's what I was hoping this record would do. So I'm sitting there and I'm going, I've got to be missing something. Because every other person on the planet I know is, you know, singing the praises of this guitar player, this band. So the next day I sit down and I do a deeper dive and I realize, oh, okay, that's what it is I was missing. That's a guitar tone that no one has ever come up with. I mean, this is groundbreaking on a level of Jimi Hendrix and in my mind, Jeff Beck. It's this monstrous sound. There's all this overdrive, but there's so much passion and feel in it. You can hear every single note he's playing, those riffs you've never quite heard before, and that combination of that rhythm and that, you know, like that lead thing that Hendrix kind of did. So following that, yes, Edward would come over to my house. I lived only about 8 minutes from Edward in the Hollywood Hills, and he'd literally drive over and bring me cassettes of the rough tracks of the second record, of the third record, of the fourth record, unmixed without vocals. And I think there were drums. I'm pretty positive there were drums. I don't even think there was bass tracks on there. And he'd sit there and he'd play these unmixed songs for me. And it was just unbelievable. You know, you're sitting there. In fact, we used to go down to his car. We'd put it on, he had a big boombox. We'd go down to his car and he'd put it on, you know, and he'd turn the boombox all the way up. You know, so he's sitting there with Edward Van Halen, listening to the unreleased track from the Van Halen 2 record, you know, man. It was just mind-blowing. And then on top of that, then we'd go back into my little pad. I have a little guest house in the Hollywood Hills.
Yeah.
And he'd pick up one of my guitars. I always had a couple of guitars lying around. And he'd play those riffs. He'd go, yeah, man, in Bottoms Up. You know, it was this. Yeah. And he'd play the riff from Bottoms Up, you know, acoustically on my electric unplugged. And so not only did I hear the mixes, you know, now he's playing those riffs in front of me and I'm watching him and you realize, my God, how astonishingly good he really was. You know, I mean, you see it up close, unamplified, you think, well, how good can he be? And he was. It was remarkable to me. I mean, I'd never seen anything like that.
Oh, wow. I've got goosebumps just listening to you say that, and I wasn't there. you were with them through the whole of the Warners kind of period, through Women and Children First and Fair Warning. Absolutely incredible. So, and he only literally was 8 minutes up the road from you. So did you get to know the rest of the band as well?
Not as well. Right. I knew the other three guys certainly by being Edward's friend. I met Michael several times. I thought he was the nicest guy. Let me backtrack just a little, Phil. Back in 1985, I had asked Edward, writers are going to come to you because they want to write your life story. I would like to write your life story, you know. And he said, yes, of course you could do, you know, I couldn't think of anybody else doing it. So I began working on his authorized biography back in 85, 84, 85.
Wow. So just before that would be before Sammy Hagar joined, was it? Or just
that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. About a year and a half or two years before Sammy joined. So I had sat down with Michael to interview him for what was going to be the book back then. And we spent a couple days, you know, and I spoke to him at length. I also spoke to Alex for the book. And Alex knew me because I was hanging out a lot with his brother. And Alex would be up at Edwards, up at 5150, and I'd run into him there. Typically, I'd run into Alex. They used to have like these huge open rehearsals, pre-production rehearsals before they'd go out in the room. And I'd see Al there. I saw him backstage a few times, and we got along really well. Again, I was never, I wouldn't say I was friends with Alex or Michael. We were friendly. And Dave, I saw one or two times, interviewed Dave once, and, you know, famously Dave was Dave. And, you know, we got along well. Again, I didn't really know Dave that well, but I knew the other guys, and they kind of knew me because I was hanging out with Edward. So, yeah, it was cool.
Because in the UK, because where I was growing up, I was learning, like a lot of my friends at school, we were learning to play guitar, and Guitar Player magazine was American. So the only access we had was these omnibus books that appeared. And nearly all of the guitarists that we followed back then were kind of UK-based, Deep Purple, Rory Gallagher, Wishbone Ash, Led Zeppelin, Cream. And the first American band that kind of popped up above the, you know, parapet was Montrose in 73, which are also on Warner Brothers. So it was Ronnie Montrose in the UK. That first album was huge. It didn't sell very much, but for anyone who's into rock music, it just was huge. And so produced by Ted Templeman, and it's a few years later, the first Van Halen albums almost sounded like what Ted might have wanted the next Montrose album to really be like. I mean, did you ever talk to Ronnie Montrose at all in your...
I did so, and I love your analogy there that, you know, the first Van Halen record could have been the follow-up Montrose record. I love that record too, man. I thought it was the best thing. Honestly, I thought it was the best thing Sammy ever did. That was great. I did interview Ronnie. I want to say 75, 76. I'm sorry, Phil?
That's that they were kind of Warner Brothers Presents Jump On It period. Yeah.
Exactly. I think it was right around there. For a Guitar Player magazine. And I was a big Montrose family a fan. I loved that first Montrose record. I loved his playing. And he was cool. We had a really great conversation. And I will now, since you bring up Ronnie Montrose, I will make that connection how Ronnie comes up in the book. Certainly, we all know that Sammy Hagar was the singer in Ronnie Montrose's band, and Sammy would ultimately join Van Halen. However, I'm there in 78, I think it was July 78. Van Halen plays Day on the Green. That were those huge shows that the promoter Bill Graham would put on, where he'd bring all these different bands together for one day. So this was like Van Halen's first really big gig away from that tour they had been on.
When they were with Sabbath, yeah.
Exactly. And Journey and then Sabbath. So I'm there, and I'd only met Edward one time at this point. I'm there, and I'm backstage. My friend Neil Zlozauer, the famous Van Halen photographer who shot the front and back covers of the books, he says, hey, you want to meet Eddie Van Halen? So I go backstage, and I say hello to Edward. And again, I don't think he remembered who I was. earlier in the day, I had arrived early. The show started at 10. I was there at 10. I was there to interview Mick Jones. Foreigner was headlining, and Guitar Player wanted that story. I knew Van Halen were playing, and I wanted to see them play live. I'm backstage, and there was kind of like a common compound set up with like picnic tables, and all the bands could hang out and congregate. So I'm there just hanging out. I just arrived, and I'm eating a sandwich or drinking a cup of coffee or something. And I see Ronnie Montrose over in the corner. I go, oh, boy, man, I'm going to go say hello. So I walk over and I see him look at me. And I think I sense sort of a glimpse of recognition, like he remembers who I am. And I walk over, I go, Ronnie, hi, how are you, man? Good to see you, you know? And he says, well, yeah. I can't remember exactly what he said, but it wasn't nice. And, yo, man, that interview you wrote, man, that was a lie. And I hated that interview, man. And you're a fucker.
Oh, dear.
I go, wow, man, I am sorry. Honestly, Phil, I have no idea what that was about. I would later learn that Ronnie suffered from severe, severe depression all his life. And I believe he took his own life. Right. He committed suicide. So I talked to some people. I even talked to a Guitar Player and they said, no, I doubt if it's anything you did. It was just Ronnie. So that was very sad. I mean, I had no idea about that. Guitar Player actually put on a little benefit for Ronnie after his passing. And Jim Crockett, the editor, asked if they could, use my Ronnie Montrose's interview as part of the program. And I said, yes, of course, No, he was an amazing guitar player, man. I mean, he influenced a lot of those guys who would come after him over here as well. So, he's great.
So Eddie was a very, very different personality to Ronnie. Whereas Ronnie kind of like always thought, well, I've done that, so everyone's expecting me to do that next, so I'm definitely not going to do that next. I'm going to do something completely different, which must have wound up Ted Templeman and Warner Brothers. Eddie Van Halen just went with what they wanted to do. I mean, from my perspective, and obviously I'd never met Eddie Van Halen, but all we saw was the photographs, saw the band on stage. They just looked like the ultimate party band. Eddie was always smiling, whereas most guitarists in the UK, like Richie Blackmore, always looked mean and moody. There were no photographs of them smiling. Whereas Eddie just looked like fun. I mean, was he naturally a positive guy? Always, literally, that's how he came across.
You know, your observation is correct, Phil. Edward loved nothing better than to play. And being on stage was that was paradise for him. And yes, they had that designation as a party band, but Edward really took what he did seriously. I don't think he ever thought, well, I did that on the first record, the second record. It's got to be, the tracks have to be a little longer, and maybe I need to expand solo seconds. He never thought like that. It really was an organic approach with him. And it's just, what he was writing in the moment. He never really took into account what he thought his audience might want, which made him pretty unbelievable as an artist. But when he was in the studio and working, and even though the records tended to come together pretty quickly, because he was such an amazing, amazing guitar player, and I was never in the studio with Edward, but I can't imagine it would take him more than a couple of takes to put down a guitar part, his solos, a lot of them were written in the studio. He never planned out his solos. So in answer to your question, Phil, Edward was really two people. He was that person on stage, the smiling Eddie. Ed, we love you. Eddie, do your solo. Off stage, he was Edward. And that was the guy that I knew. Very self-assured, humble, egoless. Never, ever heard him say, man, did you hear that solo I did on the last record? Was that the most amazing thing you'd ever heard? Or my God, you know, Blackmore's solo on, you know, Speed King, man. He just never talked like that. He knew who he was and he knew how good he was, but he just never had to tell you about that. And he really never wanted to hear it. I also had to walk a fine line between being his friend and being this journalist who had to interview him from time to time. And, you know, part of me wanted to just, you know, sit there and bow down to him the way everybody else did and say, my God, Edward, those are the most amazing solos I ever heard and your songs. And but whenever I would do that, he would like draw back and he'd go, yeah, it's almost like he was angry, as if my comments were somehow belittling the artistry of it. So I tried not to do that. But yes, Edward, that person you see on stage, the smiles, that was who he was. People sensed that about him. Everybody felt like he was their next door neighbor and their best friend. Whereas, yes, Ritchie or Black or, you know, Page or, you know, Jeff Beck, even the guys in Wishbone Ash, I love those guys. I mean, one of my favorite bands. There was always that distance, you know, we're the musician and you're the audience and never that twain shall meet. But with Edward, it was different. But off stage, man, he was a serious dude. And if he felt his music was being disrespected, and that could come out like the other band members not working hard enough or working as hard as he thought they should be, that made him unhappy, you know, and that would ultimately lead to some pretty big divisions in the band. So,
interesting. Yeah. Because you mentioned that when you first ever met him, we were talking about he was a fan of Eric Clapton and Ritchie Blackmore and all this. But the thing is with Eddie Van Halen, you can't hear any of those players in his guitar playing. Whereas from 1978 going forwards through the 80s, of all the rock bands that came after that, especially in the 80s, like the Dokken's and the Rats and the Warrants, and you can hear Eddie Van Halen in everybody. Mm. Everybody took some Eddie Van Halen with them. And I mean, did he ever talk about how he felt about that? That literally everybody seemed to have taken part of him into their sound.
He did talk about that, Phil, and he personally didn't like it. I don't think he's looked on it. Again, as I described earlier, he didn't look on that as a compliment or, you know, that all these other guitar players, and those were some pretty good guitar players.
Yeah, they were. Yeah.
Right. You know, were sort of, yes, bringing his licks into the fold, as it were. He never looked at it like that. He said to me, and it's in the book, I think they should go out and find their own thing. You know, I can't remember the exact terminology, but that was how he felt about it. So, yeah, I don't think that was like any kind of huge gratifying thing for him to hear that. He actually talked about Rick Derringer at one point, that Rick virtually stole his solo and stuff like that. And that didn't make him very happy at all. And on the other side of that, Phil, the fact that you cannot hear Clapton or Blackmore really in his playing is pretty amazing. I've talked to some guys, and I go, yeah, man, you can hear Blackmore here and there. And I go, dude, you're only saying that because you know that Edward loved Ritchie Blackmore, right? It's after the fact. And yeah, I could look at that and I could probably find one lick that had a quasi Eric Clapton finger tremolo or something, but there's just no way on earth, you know, which was made him remarkable. The thing about Ed, and I'll be quick about this, you know, so back in the day before, you know, he was playing the Whiskey before they were doing original music, they were a cover band, right? They were playing Gazzaris. And, you know, he was doing covers from everybody from Cream, The Who. I understand that he used to sing a mean version of Substitute, I think it was. ZZ Top, Purple, you know, Grand Funk. So all of that was being, you know, meshed together. You know, how any of it came out sounding like Edward, I'm not sure. But he was certainly aware of those guys. But yeah, he never sounded like that. I actually thought there were bits, you know, again, just bits. I thought there was a little bit more of Pete Townsend in there. Not from Pete's solo stuff, because that really wouldn't have influence him. But a lot of those chords, you know, those fest chords that Pete used to do, and you know what I mean? And Edward, you know, had actually been in contact with Pete. Edward was thinking about doing a solo record with, he was going to bring in different people. Patti Smythe, who he was hanging out with at the time, who, you know, gossip has it was going to be the new singer in Van Halen, Phil Collins, Pete Townsend. And I thought that would have been a remarkable, you know, sort of thing happening, you know, with Pete's writing and Edward's writing and all that. But that never happened, of course. But I always kind of heard a little bit of Pete in there, a little bit of Billy Gibbons, a little bit of ZZ Top, you know. But yeah, I mean, to pinpoint those other influences, I mean, it's beyond me for sure.
I think it's because all the people we talk about, Jimmy Page, Richie Blackmore, Eric Clapton, bringing Leslie West as well, they all, everyone, they've all got Rory Gallagher, the Wishbone guys, that they all had Dave Gilmour, Tony Iommi, they just keep Jeff Beck. They've all had their own unique sound, and Eddie carried on that tradition. But as Van Halen took off into outer space, literally, all these other bands were kind of either splitting up or coming to the end of their natural world domination element. And so going into the 80s, to where I was in the UK, Van Halen were like the Rolls Royce of rock bands. They were the ones that everyone looked at to see what they were going to do next, which is, I guess, why so many bands in the 80s kind of took a little bit of Eddie into their repertoire, into their songwriting and lead playing and such. But Eddie, I mean, I'm thinking of the album Fair Warning, which was had a more serious element to it. It wasn't so kind of free-fall party kind of riffage that the others had. This was, I felt, Fair Warning is my favorite Van Halen album, by the way. And I wondered whether he'd approach that one slightly differently. I don't know whether that's in the book about that specific album.
I mean, that's so funny you say that, Phil. I think that's probably my favorite record as well. And yes, for Edward, that was an entirely new approach. He now had time to really explore the guitar. I mean, look, they always had the crunch of releasing a record a year, but somehow he had more time to, you know, delve into the guitar. So it's really the first record where you hear multi-layered guitar parts, right? You know, tons of different tracks of rhythm parts. You know, his solos are more structured, and, you know, and solos are floating over each other. There's lots of little, what Edward called and what I called noodle parts, you know, some little, you know, guitar thing that would come in just over, you know, maybe the second verse to build the verse. So yes, it was an entirely different approach. I actually described it in a book, because you call it Darkville. I mean, I said, Ed, were you an angry young man when you were recording Fair Warning? And he kind of laughed and he goes, why? I go, why, man? Because it's a really angry sounding record, you know? And he goes, yeah. No, he didn't get that, you know? And he says, are you sure it's not because of the cover? You know, because the cover was kind of
that's true.
Kind of that dark painting. I said, no, man, it was, you know, it had a dark thing to it. But yeah, his playing on that record was just amazing. And, he was telling me, you know, one of those tracks, well, a lot of the tracks have a lot of guitars, but one of them really had a lot of guitar parts that Edward spent a lot of time building. And I think he even blew away, and this is what he was telling me, he even blew away Ted. I mean, look, Ted certainly recognized Edward's talent and stuff, but I think on that song, on that record, I think he really blew away Ted. You know, for Edward, it was always, and he talked about this a couple times, and this comes into a little bit about that disrespect thing I was talking about. So none of the other band members wrote. I mean, they didn't write anything. He and Alex, you know, spent a lot of time together. And, you know, when Ed was working out riffs, Alex may have been experimenting with, you know, grooves or different fills. But it's not like Alex came in with even the simplest part. I mean, he wasn't a songwriter. I don't think he played a melodic instrument. I take that back. He played violin. He was actually a very good violin player. You know, he wasn't a songwriter. You know, Mike didn't write. And Dave's contribution was after a track was handed to him, he put on lyrics and melodies. So nobody else in the band wrote. So it was always, you know, before they go into a record, and Edward's telling me this, and again, his tone of voice suggests this, like this laissez-faire attitude of the guy saying, well, what do you got now, Eddie? You know, we don't have to do anything. This is my interpretation a little bit. We don't have to do anything. Eddie's got a bag full of riffs. He'll come in with it, you know. That being said, when he went in to do the Fair Warning record, he worked on that so long and hard, he actually lost, I think he said, like 40 pounds. He got sick. Wow. I mean, really sick. He developed an ulcer. Excuse me. He told me he was taking Maalox. And I kind of laughed, not because he had an ulcer, but my brother didn't have an ulcer, but Maalox is one of these, it's like an over-the-counter thing that it tastes like chalk, you know, it's meant to help you, but it's pretty heavy, you know, medicine. And I kind of laughed because I recognized that from my brother. And Edward thought, no, man, I was really sick, as if I was laughing because he was sick or something. And Ed would do that sometimes. I would laugh sometimes as a nervous laugh, because he had played something that I thought was so great, and I kind of laughed, like I was astonished by it. And he'd almost take it as an insult. And I know I'm jumping around here, but yes, Fair Warning was absolutely a hop, skip, and a jump above everything else they had done. And really, for hardcore Van Halen fans, you know, guys who really know, they will look at that and go, yes, that is the best guitar playing that he had done to that day.
Even though he was at the top of his game, like a lot of creative people, from what you've just said, he was very sensitive soul as well. As you say, obviously his music was so, it was coming from the heart. He felt he was literally burying his soul by saying, this is my new music. So if you gave like a nervous laugh, he would instantly think you don't like it rather than thinking you enjoy it.
That's exactly right, man. And then I have to back up He played me a solo, or I had responded to solo off one of the songs on Fair Warning. And he said something about, you know, the solo and trying not to go overboard and be a psychophant again and, you know, bowing down to him, because the solo was amazing. And I forget what song it was. I just said, you know, good. You know, and I kind of said it in that tone of voice, well, didn't you like it? You know, and it's exactly what you said. One, I was blown away that he would have thought that I wasn't just killed by it. And two, honestly, that in a way he respected my opinion so much that him thinking I didn't like it would have touched him in such a way. So it was an amazing thing. But yes, he really was an extraordinarily sensitive soul. And I think that's also what people responded to from his playing, that they knew every note that he played meant something to him. And again, there are some extraordinary guitar players in this world. But sometimes you think, well, maybe, you know, it doesn't mean as much to them as these notes meant to Edward. Look, I'm just talking out loud here, but that's what elevated Edward above all those other extraordinary guitar players we're talking about. You know, I'm not talking about the Jeff Becks and the Jimi Hendrixes and those Apex guys, but all these other remarkable guitar players. What was it that they didn't have that Edward had? And I think it's this unseen, this unfelt thing that you talk about, this heart and this passion, and you know that when you're hearing him, this is who the guy is, you know.
The other thing, of course, we mentioned the other guitarists of the time. They obviously had some stagecraft, like Jimmy Page did. And you think about, you know, the Led Zeppelin, the film. That's how visually a lot of us saw them. You know, and the poses and Ritchie Blackmore and all the rest of it. But Eddie took the stagecraft of the being so photogenic, and also the way he did all his guitar poses and threw all those shapes. He just looked like he had complete command of not only the guitar, but also his physical presence on stage. He just looked so confident. I mean, did he just love playing live? Was he confident? Did he ever have stage fright or any nerves, or did he just think, this is who I am?
I mean, you bring up an excellent point. I was talking to Niels Lozauer, the photographer. He was Van Halen's official photographer for many years from the first record on. Neil took the famous shot of Ed on the second record. Of Dave with the cast on his foot because Dave had broken his foot, blah, blah, blah. I said to Neil, I go, and Neil's probably taken 10,000 photos of Edward. I said, did Ed ever take a bad picture? And he goes, no. Which goes to your point that yes, whenever I saw Edward, he had a guitar in his hand. I mean, always, not some of the time, always. If I walked into 5150, he was sitting in the studio chair with a guitar. If he came over to the pad, he had a guitar. Wherever he went, he jammed. I believe when he was on stage, he was 100% confident. I don't think he ever had a taste of nerves or stage fright. And yes, the way he walked and the way he looked and the way he held the guitar, and I write about this, it was just so, it was so beautiful. It was so perfect, you know, and his hands and his arms were amazing, you know, and it just, the way the guitar was draped around his neck. He did say one time, you know, he goes, well, you know, usually my solos on stage, you know, I work them out a little bit, but it's pretty much kind of live. And he goes, well, you know, but for the next tour, I've got to work something out. But he was aware of that. But it's not like he was afraid that he could somehow couldn't come up with a great solo or something. And going back to that day on the Green gig, so here's Edward, and you know, he's this young kid. He's now playing on a bill. AC/DC opened. This is like before AC/DC. I think it was their first tour of the States in 78.
Yeah.
First record, something around there. But, you know, it's AC/DC and Aerosmith and Foreigner and Pat Travers, you know. And Edward knew about all those bands. But here he is, you know, stepping away from this tour where they're opening to having their own slot, you know. And I just remember being backstage with the guy, and I was thinking to myself, I didn't say anything to him. My God, the guy is like, you know, it's like he's playing a gig at the Whiskey. I mean, he was laughing. He was joyful. He could not wait to get on stage.
Wow.
Yeah, he was amazing. Yeah, I don't think he ever, ever had stage fright in his life. I really don't. Yeah.
The album after Fair Warning, Diver Down, that's the one that in the UK almost looked, that one didn't have such good reviews. It was almost as if it was quite a short album. It was a lot of cover versions and stuff. And you mentioned earlier about everyone just looked at Eddie and said, what songs have you got? Because they didn't bring anything to the table. Was that like a period where he hadn't got so many ideas, or that didn't seem such a happy album, although it was still a party album, if you know what I mean?
Right. I don't think I specifically asked him those kinds of questions, Phil, but he was really unhappy with that, with the covers. And those covers weren't his ideas. Were they put there because he didn't have enough songs? I don't know, because, I mean, some of those other songs on the record were actually good songs, and had the covers, or maybe one cover been there, you know, I think people would have looked at it differently. But yeah, he might have... I mean, maybe the whole band took the easy way out for that record. It was certainly, a letdown after what had come before. Edward was never a fan of covers, you know. He talks famously about Dancing in the Streets. That was an entirely different riff he had for one of his own songs.
Oh.
And Ted heard it and goes, oh, that would be great for a remake of Dancing in the Streets, you know. And some of those covers were at the behest of Dave. You know, Dave liked doing covers. So, I guess it's a democracy at that point. But yes, that record certainly wasn't one of the band's high marks.
The one after that obviously was enormous. 1984, they became the biggest band everywhere, even in the UK. They were just massive after that. And of course, we know after that, we move into the Sammy Hagar period, and also he lets go of Ted Templeman as the producer for the first time in six albums. So there was a huge change. But also I felt there was a change in the way that Eddie was writing songs, because I guess he was writing with somebody more with Sammy Hagar than he was prior to that. Did you feel that that time that he was changing his approach, not to guitar playing, but to song structure and wanting a different producer?
It is strange. I mean, they come out with 1984, you know, they're, you know, I look at 1984 like, you know, Supertramp, Crime of the Century, or, you know, Pink Floyd's, you know, Dark Side of the Moon. Like they're opus, they're epic.
Yeah, totally. You know, totally.
Right. He's had 5150, his home studio built. He's now more actively involved in it. Letting Ted go. I didn't know about it. But I think that he wanted to be more involved. I know that when Sammy first came into the band, Ed was overjoyed. You know, Sammy brought, you know, a more musical kind of a vision to the band, just in terms of the fact that, you know, Sammy played guitar. You know, Sammy as a singer had a bigger range than Dave. I'm not saying it was better or worse than Dave.
Just different, yeah.
You know, just different. I never really talked to Edward about that songwriting process too much. You know, I don't know if for Ed it really was that different. I think it was still Edward coming up with the music and then presenting it to Sammy. You know, with Sammy there at points when Ed was working on the music and coming up with riffs and with Sammy suggested guitar change, that's possible. I honestly don't know. But the 1984 record was, I mean, it was unbelievable. I mean, his guitar tone goes to a new level, you know, and you know, the way he's worked the studio and, you know, and then ultimately bringing in Mick Jones for the 5150 record, which I thought on paper was a pretty interesting choice. I mean, Mick was an astonishingly good songwriter, yeah. You know, obviously had a successful band and, you know, had been around, and I thought he would have brought a lot to it. I don't think Edward cared for that collaboration too much. Edward talked a little bit about it, and he said, you know, Mick didn't really do much. So, you know, and then famously, Ted would return, and I write about that in the book. You know, Edward talks about Ted at moments that Ted was really critical to what they did. And then at other moments, he talked about Ted, that Ted didn't really recognize what Edward brought, you know, what he was capable of. And, you know, he got pretty, you know, angry about some things, you know. So the fact that Ted would come back, I thought that was odd, you know, really odd. And the fact that ultimately Don Landy, the engineer, would be let go, I thought, wow, that one I never saw coming. But, you know, it was his life. I mean, you know, his music, and he needed to change. So, you know, those are the choices he made.
All of those albums to me are just as they're classics. All the entire Van Halen back catalog. Van Halen 3 is the only kind of one where it kind of drifts to in my mind, you know. But obviously, it's almost like an album every year, one every 2 years. When we head out of the 80s and into the 90s, this is when everything slows down, doesn't it? After Balance and the trial of a different vocalist, it all just goes quiet. Were you still connected to Eddie then? What was going on that made him literally just almost retreat from being like at the top of the, you know, his career at that point?
Right. No, I understand that, Bill. So if we're really, you know, if we sort of use the Van Halen 3 record as the sort of the focal point here, so this is 95, yeah. 96. And I write about it in the book, and I don't want to give anything away, but, you know, not there's any secrets, but Edward had been changing, and I recognized that honestly, probably from the early 90s, years before the Van Halen 3 record. And he had become a different person. He was, the friendship had not grown. In fact, it had really gotten smaller. He had changed. He had become, at least to my mind, more introverted. I saw him less and less, to a point where whenever I needed to interview him, I would call him and go, "Ed, you know, Guitar World needs a story. Can we get together? Yeah, come by next Tuesday, you know, come up to the studio. We'll talk, you know." Or, "Edward, you know, Japan," I was writing for Japanese magazines, and Van Halen and Japan were, you know, gods. "You know, Player Magazine wants a story. Can we do something?" "Yeah, man, come by tomorrow," blah, blah, blah. It got to the point where there was a conversation, and I don't want to get into details because you could read about that. I think it's really interesting. But he didn't want me to call him anymore to set up the interviews. And I thought he was joking, but he was serious. And that was a nail in my heart. To the point where I would interview him because it was a day of interviews set up by Warner Brothers Records for the Van Halen 3 record. So I'm up at 5150. That's where they were holding the interviews. With, you know, a dozen other writers, and I hadn't spoken to Edward for a long time. I wasn't even going to go, but I thought, you know, I haven't seen Ed in a long time. You know, I just want to say hello, see how he is, you know. And I walk in the room, and again, I don't want to give anything away. And he looks at me, honestly, like he didn't know who I was. Only this time, it wasn't that he had forgotten, you know, he consciously didn't want to recognize who I was. I mean, he knew who I was and acted as if he didn't know. And it was a really, really mean thing. And he had changed. And I don't know, honestly, what was going on with him. I don't know. We all know that Edward got really sick, and kind of the diagnosis didn't happen until, I guess, 2000 is when we found out. Maybe he knew back then, you know, things were happening. Maybe it was the drug. I don't know, though apparently he had gotten clean and sober. I don't know what it was, but he changed. And I think that was part of everything you're talking about, Phil. Phil, yes, he retreated. Yeah, the record comes out, and then, you know, they don't make any more records. And ultimately, they'll get back together and do a record, but not for many, many years. And they do some tours together. And those are a little bit suspect. I don't know. I never spoke to him after 2003, so I never knew exactly what was happening. But yeah, you think about the legacy of a band that was together from, if you go back to when they first got together, it's like 73. But when they first start recording, it's 78. You know, so you're talking, I don't know, whatever that is, 40 years, and there's only, I don't know what it is, 13 records or something. You know, you look at these other bands, my God, they have, you know, twice that many records. So it was strange. It was sad. I wish I really had a definitive answer, you know, what was going on in his life and why he changed like that. I don't. I try to write about that. And
I mean, you yourself have had a career of going back 50 years of talking and following some of the biggest rock bands on earth through their prime years I think anyone I mentioned you were there, you know, Zeppelin, all these bands. And but you were with what was the catalyst that made you think of all these people you've worked with and written about and seen live and reviewed and all the magazines you've been in that you thought, I want to write this book about Eddie Van Halen, you know, called Tone Chaser. You know, what made you think this is the one I want to really focus on?
Meeting him before the first record comes out, I mean, I can watch this, you know, this skyrocketing thing happening with the band. The tours are getting bigger. They're selling more records. I have this rare view watching this guitar player becoming a legend in his own time. I mean, I was there. I could see it, and I'm hanging out with this guy, and again, that was part of that thing, trying to divorce myself from being the friend and the journalist. And I'm thinking, this guy that I'm hanging out with, this guy is changing the architecture of guitar playing. And I'd actually written some books previously, Phil. I actually wrote a book on Jeff Beck back in 78 that only came out in Japan.
Yeah.
You know, I wrote a book about Black Sabbath. I wrote a book about Free and Bad Company. But those are different types of books. I interviewed all those bands, but I never really become friends with them. You know what I mean? It's not like I was spending time with them outside of interviewing them. So with Edward, beyond watching this guy, watching a legend, you know, being born, it was spending that time with him. And at a point, I realized, and maybe it was the journalist in me, you know, recognizing from a cultural standpoint, look, man, you have this opportunity. You're hanging out with this guy who is changing everything about guitar. You're a writer. Write this book. And, you know, I mean, I don't know if those were the exact reasons, but and maybe it was selfish. I knew I didn't want any other writer doing it. And honestly, I didn't think any other writer could do it. Not the way I could.
Yeah,
there were other brilliant writers out there. I mean, I've all these English writers. I mean, there were amazing writers. I'm not saying that they technically, as journalists, couldn't write the book, but
they weren't there like you, were they? They weren't there like you. They weren't sitting in a room with him coming and showing you some new riffs for the next album. But only you were there for that.
Exactly. You know, and I look at it, Phil, and I'm not one to believe in destiny. I kind of really believe we make our own fate or synchronicity or what brings things together or how did Paul McCartney meet John Lennon? You know, you just
you don't
think about those things, right? But I thought, you know what? I mean, I could have been hanging out with Edward and maybe we could have met and been friends. And what if I wasn't a journalist? I'd like to think we would still been friends if we had this, shared the same interest, and maybe I was some, you know, marginal guitar player and we bonded over that, or yeah. I met him at a backyard party in Pasadena and we met. So I really thought, well, my God, you know, I am his friend and I am a writer. And you know, I thought, not that I felt like an obligation, but it's something that I had to do. I wanted to do, you know. And once I made that commitment, once I asked him that question, I worked my ass off because I wanted this book to be amazing. I wanted the book to reflect how remarkable this guy was. You know, and when that book didn't happen, I was extraordinarily disappointed. 2003, I stopped talking with Edward. 17 years left before I think, you know what? I think I'm ready to maybe write that book I didn't write in 1985. Tone Chaser isn't the antithesis of what that book would have been. But still, you know, I pored over every word in Tone Chaser and wanted to bring Edward to life. And I wanted you, the fan, the reader, to understand who this guy was and, you know, the way I understood him. So, yeah, man, it was desperately wanting to write the book, being afraid to write the book, you know, just having the rare opportunity to be a friend of a legend. I mean, you know, how many people can say that, you know?
I mean, looking on your website, some of the, you know, famous musicians who've read the book and the kind of comments they've made, that they themselves have obviously can see an insight into a musician they admire greatly and seeing a different side of him or understanding more about him because of your experience and knowledge of him. So, you know, you've had some great testimonials about the book. Is it available in the UK and Europe?
It is available. I actually have, he's kind of a friend. He's actually a Van Halen fanatic, Michel Finkel, who lives in the Netherlands.
Yeah.
Rather than having, you know, UK and Europe, you know, fans, having to have me ship them a book to the U.S. And trust me, I did that before I met Michelle, and it gets expensive. And I honestly feel bad about that, man. You know, but the cost to ship a book, you know, to the U.K. from the U.S. It's about $60.
Yeah,
man. And I hate that. I wish they didn't have to spend that, because none of it comes to me. You know, plus the price of the book, which I've tried to be reasonable about. But Michelle Finkel can take care of you. And I'm trying to remember Michelle's email.
Well, don't worry. I'll if you just send me an email, I'll put everything in. I'll put it at the end of this podcast, and I'll also put it on the description on YouTube, and I'll also put it on the website as well, so people can get straight in touch too if they want to buy a book.
Beautiful, you know, and people literally, I think they saved like, you know, 60% on shipping, because it's coming from the Netherlands to the UK or the Netherlands to, you know, Germany or whatever. So yes,
no problem at all.
Absolutely.
Well, so thank you very much, Steve, for all of your time today. This has been fascinating. And and there's so much more I'd like to talk to you about on other bands and guitarists and stuff. But I wanted to keep this focused on Eddie, and especially your book, Tone Chaser, which looks fantastic. And obviously, there's lots of stories to explore in that book. And obviously, you've been friends with someone like Eddie Van Halen, especially when you... your experience of being with all these bands and talking to all these major guitarists. And you, of course, you're a guitarist yourself, which must have given you extra insight. I mean, I play guitar as well, so I know that to be able to talk to another musician as a musician gives you extra insight into what they do as well anyway. Just before we go, I suppose that should be my final question. As you are also a guitar player, did you feel an edge over some other journalists who were just writers?
I absolutely believe that's true. And I've absolutely believed that's been true for every interview I've ever done. In the book I write, you know, a lot of writers will call themselves music journalists or classic rock journalists. I always called myself a rock guitar journalist, because I love guitar players. And being a guitar player, I really understood them. Look, I'm not saying I ever played anything like them. I'm not saying I had, you know, that kind of that, you know, tech knowledge of knowing, you know, what kind of wire was used in a PAF, you know, or what year was best. I didn't have that kind of knowledge. I mean, there are a lot of other writers who understand that much better. But yes, being a guitar player and being a songwriter, I understood when Ed was talking about, you know, guitar changes or, you know, I could watch him on the guitar and understand, oh my God, that's, you know, he's doing that. And I could talk to Joe Perry about writing songs and you know, Richie in his way and Jimmy Page, and they could talk like that. And I understood that. And I think guitar players sense that in me. So yes, absolutely, being a guitar player helped immeasurably becoming even a closer friend with Edward. And my last little bit here, Phil, is I jammed with Edward like 3 times, and we were playing and I blew him away. I'm kidding. I was so afraid I could barely, you know, keep my fingers from freezing. But I write about that in the book. And Phil, I know you wanted to talk about some of your other guys and all those bands you are my favorites. Rory, Leslie West, who is one of the all-time greats, and there's a little bit of Leslie's playing. Ed was a huge fan of Leslie. Wishbone Ash, you know, Beck, Zeppelin, Blackmore, Kossoff. I would love to come on if you'll have me again, man, and we could have a conversation about that.
Steve, this has been fantastic, and we'll definitely do another show, and I'd love to talk about some of those other guitarists, especially Leslie and Kossoff and Blackmore. That would be absolutely brilliant. But for thank you so much for your time. And what's the name of your website again, Steve, so people can know where to find you?
Very simple. ToneChaserBook.com.
There you go, ToneChaserBook.com. So you find out all about Steve and the book from there. And I'll put the information about where, if you're in UK and Europe, where you can buy the book a lot easier than importing it from the States. So thanks again, Steve. Take care. And I look forward to talking to you very, very soon. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Phil. See you, bud.
A huge thank you to my guest, Steve Rosen. what stories he has. I mean, the book Tone Chaser tells the story of his 26-year friendship with Eddie Van Halen. I mean, it sounds fascinating. The links will be at the end of this video or down below in the description, and they'll be on the Now Spinning Magazine website as well. But I'm absolutely thrilled to have spoken to Steve, because as I talk to people here on the podcast, Steve was there at that time, the golden age of what we class as classic rock. You know, the Zeppelin, ZZ Top, Aerosmith, Deep Purple, Pink Floyd, Jeff Beck's, Richie Blackmore's, Jimmy Page's, everybody you can possibly think of. That time in rock history when you had to write to the fan club, you bought Sounds, New Musical Express, Melody Maker, and that was, you couldn't get near these rock and roll heroes. And Steve was there going on the plane with them, reviewing their albums on the tours. You know, I'm definitely going to be talking to Steve again on the Now Spinning Magazine podcast. We're going to talk about other bands he was with, the Zeppelins and Purple, Paul Kossoff, all sorts of people. It's absolutely, this has been great, I have to say. Absolutely wonderful to talk to Steve. So thank you for listening and watching. And thank you for subscribing. Please ring that little bell if you're watching this on YouTube. Subscribe to the podcast. Check out the Now Spinning Magazine website. Check us out on Twitter and Instagram. Join the Facebook private group if you'd like to talk to other collectors and music fans. And remember, music is the healer and the doctor. So take care. Keep spinning those discs. And I shall see you very, very soon.